the reactionary forces in this country a little on the hypocritical side in light of the fact that all of his work on generative linguistics, which made his name as a psycholinguist, I studied Noam Chomsky in college, I was a psychology major, all of his work on generative linguistics was financed by the Pentagon. Chomsky does not deny this, he simply rationalizes it, saying it's all alienated labor, an explanation I find less than convincing. The same explanation could be given for just about anything. You could talk to the El Salvadorian junta and the families they represent about the enormous injustices, economic and legal, that are visited upon the El Salvadorian population. They could say, well, it's all alienated labor. You could talk to Neil Bush about his excesses in regard to the Silverado savings and loan. It's all alienated labor. You could talk to Oliver North about the numerous references to contra drug dealing in his diaries. It's all alienated labor. The same thing would work for anything. So I don't find that explanation particularly satisfying under the circumstances. And again, this is not to single Chomsky out, but rather to touch on his intellectual orthodoxy as exemplary of the type of knee-jerk reaction that takes place not just in this society, but in all societies, in my estimation. I view intellectual culture as inherently reactionary. Once something has come to be accepted as truth, evidence that demonstrates that it is not true will tend to be overlooked by the vast majority of people. And I view that type of intellectual orthodoxy, particularly on the part of the progressive political spectrum, as extremely destructive. And in my estimation, that has brought us to, in large measure, to our very, very sorry state. And again, the entire progressive political community lined up en masse to dump on Oliver Stone, to dump on Jim Garrison. And I think that is an extremely regrettable situation. Not only does it help to blind us to our own political heritage and to the political forces which were ascendant on November 22, 1963, it has also been an enormous personal tragedy. A great many sincere individuals who have attempted to pursue the truth about President Kennedy's assassination have been marginalized, their lives have been ruined, and many of them have been absolutely ridden out of intellectual culture. And yet, the investigation has gone forward. By way of illustrating one of the things that I find essential about investigating Kennedy's assassination, one of the things that I find most distressing about a stance like Chomsky's, is that this is not an abstract intellectual exercise. Apart from coming to recognize the political forces that destroyed John Kennedy, it should be understood that a great deal of harm came out of that particular event. The forces that precipitated that were at work well before 11-22-63. They have proceeded unimpeded since that time, and a lot of people have died. Not only the scores of thousands of American soldiers who died in Vietnam, not to mention the millions of Vietnamese, an awful lot of other people inside and outside of this country have died as a result of the excesses of the forces that took control on November 22, 1963. In the Guns of November that I did in November of 1983 on the 20th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, I suggested a metaphor that John Kennedy's assassination could be looked upon as the waste of an hourglass. The forces that were at work for many, many years before Kennedy's assassination came together in the waste of that hourglass, and the forces that acted in that way at that time, in that place, have proceeded forward from that waste to an hourglass, and they're the forces that dominate this world today. But an awful lot of people, awful lot of very good people, as well as a lot of bad people, have bitten the dust, have suffered grievously and mortally as a result of the actions of those forces that proceeded unimpeded, and I think it is extremely destructive to cling to that type of orthodoxy, although, again, that is a basic principle of intellectual culture, in my opinion. It is distressing to find the progressive political segment of this country subscribing to these same totally untenable theories, basically the geocentric theory of the universe. It should be noted, too, that there is a very strong CIA influence in the progressive media, as there is in the mainstream media. The effects of that CIA infiltration should not be overlooked in assessing the activities of the progressive political community. This is not to imply that Noam Chomsky is CIA. I don't want to be misunderstood on that particular category. And again, I find this a basic principle of intellectual culture, citing again that old Chinese proverb, You can't teach a pig to sing, and if you try, you'll annoy him. By way of taking a look at just some of that body of information which Noam Chomsky has chosen not to look at, and a great many people along with him, including the progressive political section, segment, I should say, we're going to begin by rereading a section of an article which appeared in the San Francisco Examiner on Friday, May 29th of 1992. Ironically enough, that was Kennedy's birthday, as well as that of Mae Brussel, a long-departed and dear colleague. This is a Reuters story by Gene King. It's headlined, JFK X-rays phony, technicians say, subheaded, two Navy men say they witnessed autopsy and claim photos, quote, are wrong, unquote. It reads in part, two Navy medical technicians who said they had witnessed the autopsy of President John F. Kennedy said Thursday autopsy photographs and X-rays recently released by the government had been tampered with and falsified. Gerald Custer, as in George Armstrong, J-E-R-R-O-L, who took X-rays of Kennedy's body at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland the night of the assassination, November 22, 1963, told a news conference Thursday that the X-rays, quote, are wrong, unquote. He said the released X-rays showed a black hole where the right side of Kennedy's face should be, indicating that a portion of the face had been destroyed. But he said, quote, there was no damage to his face and no part of his skull was missing on the forward part of his head. These are fake X-rays. Photographer Floyd Reeb, or Reebe, R-I-E-B-E, who took pictures of the body during the autopsy, said the photographs released by the government were phony and not the photographs we took, unquote. Testimony by people directly involved that there is, in fact, or was falsification of evidence. The story is, in fact, considerably grimmer than that. As I've said, one of the things that's important to study about Kennedy's assassination, not only to understand the political forces at work, what they were involved with, what their beliefs were, and again, the core of the Kennedy assassination was an explicitly fascist group, but basically they have gone forward, and an awful lot of other people, political people, as well as people involved in investigating some of the scams of the national security establishment, have been murdered in the years since. This is not an abstract intellectual exercise, and their suffering and their sacrifice, mortal sacrifice, has tragically been overlooked. Again, I'm going to take a look at some of the evidence, some of the hard evidence, and some of the indications of other things, food for thought and grounds for further research. This is by no means represents anything like a comprehensive overview of the assassination. Once again, I refer interested listeners to The Guns of November, Parts 1 through 4, Radio Free America shows 11, 12, and 13, and also number 15, as well as two miscellaneous archive shows. You can contact Archives on Audio to get that information. This particular book I read from it last week is called Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. It's published it was authored by Penn Jones of the Midlothian Mirror, and it's copyrighted in softcover 1969. And we're going to hear about an individual who was involved, what happened to an individual involved with taking the autopsy photographs of President Kennedy. One of Penn Jones' specialties has been to investigate many very, very suspicious deaths involved with one aspect or another of this country's political assassinations. This particular death is that of Lieutenant William Pitzer, P-I-T-Z-E-R, one of the autopsy photographers at the Bethesda Naval Hospital autopsy of President Kennedy, an autopsy many have felt was falsified, and indeed, Colonel Fink, one of the autopsy surgeons, has testified in a court of law that he was ordered by unnamed superior officers not to dissect the neck wound. That has the power of law. The Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission. It had no legal status whatsoever. It was part of the executive branch of the government, not the judicial. Of the death of Lieutenant William Pitzer, a supposed suicide, Penn Jones writes as follows. Of all the strange deaths we have reported, the death of Lieutenant William Pitzer, P-I-T-Z-E-R, is one of the most glaring removals of an important witness. Lieutenant Pitzer served as President Kennedy's autopsy photographer. He had to see the wounds to take his pictures, pictures which have never been available to qualified researchers. Pitzer told friends that his debriefing after the photographic session was a, quote, horrifying experience, unquote, and he stated that he was visited periodically by military personnel who reminded him repeatedly never to reveal, for reasons of, quote, national security, unquote, what he saw while taking pictures. Lieutenant Pitzer was found dead just before he was due to retire after 28 years in the service. A co-worker with Lieutenant Pitzer at the Bethesda, Maryland Naval Hospital, who would not be identified, reported to the Sun News of Waukegan, Illinois, May 1, 1975, that Lieutenant Pitzer's death, October 29, 1966, was ruled, quote, self-inflicted, unquote. The co-worker said, again quoting, he was shot with a .45 caliber pistol and was found with a gun in his right hand, but he was left-handed, unquote. The former hospital worker added, quote, I've always believed he was murdered, unquote. The informant went on, and again quoting, they said he was depressed, but he was close to retirement and had just received an offer to work for a network television station at $45,000 a year. I would add, in 1966, $45,000 a year would have been well over the equivalent of $100,000 a year, plus he would have received his military pension. The depressed scenario here reminds me of the death of Joseph Daniel Casolaro, an investigative reporter pursuing scams of the National Security Establishment in the Reagan and Bush administrations. He was a supposed suicide as well. The evidence for that is extremely dubious. He also supposedly was depressed. So the falsification of the x-rays and the photos described by those two technicians, Mr. Custer and Reeby, has a more serious side to it. There is a mortal aspect to the investigation of that particular story. Again, the death of Lieutenant William Pitzer. I want also point out that there were many other people, aside from some of the ones that we covered in the Guns of November Part 2, who were murdered in connection with one aspect or another of the investigation into President Kennedy's assassination. Reading once again from Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, by the way, there were four volumes in all, in one of the suspicious deaths, dubbed Number 62 by Penn Jones, this from a section of the Midlothian Mirror, an article, I should say, July 31st, 1969, Penn Jones writes as follows. The Reverend Clyde Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, 37, was scheduled to be Jim Garrison's star witness as to the personal relationship between Clay Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald. On February 18th, 1969, the day before Johnson was to testify, he was so badly beaten he had to be taken to a hospital. He never testified. Johnson was shot to death on Wednesday, July 23, 1969, near Greensburg, Louisiana. Again, the star witness to testify about the personal relationship between Clay Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald, badly beaten the day before his testimony, never testified. Now, that was February 18, 1969, and about 5 months later, July 23, 1969, he was shot to death near Greensburg, Louisiana. Garrison's investigation was impeded by a number of different things. The FBI and the CIA and the Department of Justice refused to release documents Garrison requested. I'll talk about the Department of Justice here in a few minutes. Five different governors refused to extradite people that Garrison wanted to question in connection with his investigation. It is known that his offices were bugged. One of his investigators turned, who was obviously a turncoat, a fellow named Tom Bethel, took Garrison's trial brief and gave it to Shaw's defense attorney. It's also worth noting that a fellow named Pershing Gervais, G-E-R-V-A-I-S, has testified that he was paid by the federal intelligence agencies to infiltrate and subvert Jim Garrison's investigation. The individual at Garrison was first after, David Ferry, committed suicide. Again, suicide belongs in quotes, under very strange circumstances. One of Ferry's compatriots in the anti-Castro Cuban operation sponsored by CIA, a fellow named Eladio Del Valle, bit the dust under strange circumstances as well. We're going to take a look at one of the... There are many, many key deaths in connection with the Garrison investigation. We're going to talk about that. And bear in mind, the jury found that there had been a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, and that's the only time the Kennedy assassination has ever been in a court of law. They just could not find beyond reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw was guilty. The fact that Garrison's star witness against him was murdered, or beaten up and then murdered, may have had something to do with it. Another curious death vis-a-vis Garrison's investigation, cited by Penn Jones, and again, this is from Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, from June 20th of 1968, Penn Jones writes, Nicholas J. Chetta, C-H-E-T-T-A, M.D., 50, New Orleans Parish Coroner since 1950, died at Mercy Hospital at 10:20 p.m. Saturday, May 25th, 1968. The New Orleans Times-Picayune reported, quote, details on where he suffered the heart attack were not available on Saturday night, unquote. They were not revealed in the following papers either. In our opinion, this is one of the key murders of the continuing Kennedy assassination conspiracy and cover-up. Dr. Chetta was the coroner who served at the death of David Ferry. Dr. Chetta was the key witness regarding Perry Russo against Clay Shaw. Shaw's attorneys went into federal court only after Dr. Chetta was dead. Obviously, we cannot say for sure whether Chetta was murdered. He died supposedly of a heart attack, but it should be noted that our national security establishment has long had the ability of assassinating people in such a way as to make the assassination appear to be a natural death. But the Reverend Clyde Johnson did not die of a heart attack. He was beaten and then shot to death, a Garrison's star witness concerning the relationship between Clay Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald. We're going to read a little more about deaths in connection with the Garrison investigation. We're going to turn again to a book I used last week. This is called The Assassination of JFK, By Coincidence or Conspiracy. It was authored by the Committee to Investigate, produced by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, and written by Bernard Fensterwald, Jr. Now, a word of caution slash advice about Bernard Fensterwald. Many people, myself included, feel that Fensterwald himself may very well have been CIA. He was called to represent former CIA operative James McCord when McCord was convicted in connection with the Watergate scandal. Veteran intelligencers usually use company attorneys, and there are many of them. Beyond that, there are key omissions in this particular book in referring to Warren Commission Counsel Leon Jaworski, who later became Watergate Special Prosecutor. Fensterwald fails to mention that Jaworski sat on the board of directors of the M.D. Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit. There are other key omissions as well in this particular book. Nonetheless, it is an essential compendium for any serious library, any complete library, on the Kennedy assassination, its glaring flaws, and the probable CIA status of its author notwithstanding, and there is a lot of valuable information in here. Now, bear in mind again that David Ferry, whose documented connections to the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban milieu we went into last week, David Ferry was the very first person Jim Garrison was after, and in New Orleans, Ferry, quote, committed suicide, unquote, even though the two suicide notes both had typed signatures, and Ferry himself was afraid for his life and had asked for protection. Ferry was the individual that, one of the individuals that the House Select Committee on Assassinations recommended that the Department of Justice begin investigating. But one of Ferry's associates in the anti-Castro Cuban community, a fellow named Eladio Del Valle, small D-E-L, capital V-A-L-L-E, was also murdered, and this was accurately, was murdered. It appears probable that Ferry was murdered. Why would he type his name on the two suicide notes? But Eladio Del Valle was definitely murdered. And of Eladio Del Valle, his relationship with Ferry, and both of their deaths in connection with Garrison's investigation, Bernard Fensterwald writes as follows in Coincidence or Conspiracy. By the way, that was copyrighted in softcover in 1977 by Zebra Books. Ferry and Del Valle and their relationship to the Garrison investigation and their deaths, Fensterwald writes as follows. While there are several other areas of information relating to David Ferry's involvement with anti-Castro Cuban exiles, perhaps the most striking example of the mysterious and violent world of Ferry and his Cuban associates is provided by the late Eladio Del Valle. Eladio Del Valle was a wealthy former Cuban congressman during the Batista regime who had later become a well-known organizer of anti-Castro Cuban exiles in Miami. Eladio Del Valle had been an associate of David Ferry and had reportedly financed some of Ferry's activities through a group formed by Del Valle, the, quote, anti-communist civilian and armed forces, unquote. 3 days before David Ferry's death on February 22, 1967, investigators from New Orleans District Attorney Garrison's office made an attempt to locate Ferry's associate, Eladio Del Valle, in Miami. Garrison's men were seeking to question the wealthy Cuban exile about the extent of his association with Ferry. District Attorney Garrison's attorneys and the Miami Police Department, however, were unable to locate Del Valle until the early morning hours of February 23rd, about 12 hours after David Ferry was found dead in New Orleans. So again, they located Del Valle 12 hours after Ferry's death, and we'll find out how they found him. In Miami, at 1:34 a.m. on the 23rd, Miami Police Officer J.W. Hammond, H-A-M-M-O-N, discovered the badly mutilated body of Eladio Del Valle at a Miami parking lot. Ferry's friend had been shot in the heart at point-blank range and had also had his skull split open, apparently with an axe. Police reported that Del Valle had also apparently been tortured prior to the killing. Now, it's real tough to follow through on a criminal investigation when key people get murdered. Again, David Ferry died under very strange circumstances, probably a murder. Dr. Chetta died, quite possibly a murder. Clyde Johnson was definitely murdered, one of Garrison's star witnesses. It's awfully difficult to obtain testimony from a dead witness, and it's one of the reasons why the the legal community's investigations into the sins of the national security establishment have proved quite weak and ineffective. It should be noted that David Ferry, in addition to his documented connections to the CIA and its anti-Castro Cuban milieu, worked as a private investigator for Guy Bannister, a former FBI and naval intelligence operative whose New Orleans private detective office served as a focal point of the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban activity in New Orleans in the early 1960s. And there are strong connections between Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy in Kennedy's assassination, and the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address, occupied jointly at one point by the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban umbrella group, and Bannister's agency. Also, Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans, was operating for a time out of the same area. Now, the whole story of Oswald is absolutely absurd, that he could have defected to the Soviet Union, given top-secret information about our radar defense nets, as well as the U-2, then been allowed back into the United States, never prosecuted, began the supposed Marxist and Castro sympathizer, begins moving in anti-Castro Cuban circles in New Orleans, as well as Dallas-Fort Worth. He gets a job at the Riley Coffee Company. His employer was deeply involved with the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban group. He also gets a job at Jaggers, Childs, and Stovall, which makes maps for the U.S. Army. And then he moves to Dallas-Fort Worth and begins hanging out with white Russians and people associated with the Galen Organization, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, aerospace, high rollers, bitter anti-communists, extremely unlikely. It should be noted that many of the people involved with Guy Bannister's office died under strange circumstances. We've talked about David Ferry. Guy Bannister himself died in 1964 under strange circumstances. A fellow named Maurice Brooks Gatlin Jr., who testified to having taken $100,000from the CIA to French generals who were involved in attempting to assassinate President Charles de Gaulle of France. Maurice Brooks Gatlin, also deeply involved with the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, which later grew into the World Anti-Communist League. We went into that in the Radio Free America program number 15. Well, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, one of Bannister's investigators, died in the fall from a hotel room in Central America in 1965. In addition to Ferry and Gatlin and Bannister himself, a Bannister investigator named Hugh Ward also died in 1964. Interestingly enough, Hugh Ward was piloting a private plane in which the mayor of New Orleans, de Lesseps or Chep Morrison, was also riding and was also killed. Morrison had been considering appointing Guy Bannister deputy chief of police in New Orleans, and anything he might have revealed about the assassination or about the Bannister operations, and again, Bannister's connections to the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban efforts are well documented. Let's touch on the death of Hugh Ward, another of the deaths which eliminated people who might have provided Garrison with information. Again, reading from Coincidence or Conspiracy, Hugh Ward, W-A-R-D, worked as a private investigator for Guy Bannister's detective agency at 544 Camp Street in New Orleans, which figures prominently in several areas of information relating to Lee Oswald, David Ferry, anti-Castro Cuban exiles, and various mafia and intelligence connections. Bannister's employee, Hugh Ward, reportedly worked with another employee, David Ferry, on a number of investigations and had also been taught to fly by Ferry. There have also been unconfirmed reports that Hugh Ward had active connections to the violent right-wing Minutemen organization. Ward was killed in the crash of a small plane in Mexico in 1964, which also took the life of New Orleans Mayor de Lesseps Morrison. That's capital D-E, capital L-E-S-S-E-P-S Morrison, known as Chep Morrison, who was considering appointing Guy Bannister, a deputy chief of police, for New Orleans. So another death which helped obstruct Garrison's investigation. Whether or not that was a murder, we don't know. Certainly, Eladio Del Valle and Reverend Clyde Johnson were murdered. The others remain questionable, but the possibility of murder cannot be dismissed. Now, among the many things which helped to destroy Jim Garrison's investigation was the refusal by the U.S. Department of Justice to release documents requested by Garrison for his investigation. I would note that another darling of the progressive political community, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who had served as a liaison between the Department of Justice and the Warren Commission when the Warren Commission conducted its initial investigation slash cover-up, Ramsey Clark was the Attorney General who refused to release those documents, and he also helped frustrate the Garrison investigation by handing out disinformation about that particular investigation. We're going to read now, again, from Coincidence or Conspiracy, about Ramsey Clark, again, one of the darlings of the progressive political community. Reading now from Fensterwald's book, Ramsey Clark, who later served as Attorney General under President Johnson, was one of the Justice Department officials who worked in a liaison capacity with the investigation being conducted in 1964 by the Warren Commission. In 1967, Attorney General Clark became the subject of criticism by various Warren Commission critics, including New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. On March 2, 1967, the day after District Attorney Garrison announced the arrest of businessman Clay Shaw on charges of conspiring to assassinate President Kennedy, Attorney General Ramsey Clark stated that the FBI had already investigated Shaw, quote, in November and December of 1963, unquote, and had, again quoting, cleared, unquote, him of any involvement. The Associated Press account of Ramsey Clark's remarks stated, Clark said today the Federal Bureau of Investigation has already investigated and cleared Clay L. Shaw, a businessman arrested in New Orleans, of any part in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Clark said the Justice Department knows what Garrison's case involves and does not consider it valid. Clark said Shaw, quote, was included in an investigation in November and December of 1963, unquote. Again quoting, on the evidence that the FBI has, there was no connection found between Shaw and the assassination of the president in Dallas on November 22, 1963, unquote, Clark said. Then Fensterwald goes on to say, Ramsey Clark's statement proved to be completely inaccurate. No such investigation of Clay Shaw by the FBI or Justice Department ever took place. Within a matter of days, Attorney General Clark retracted his statement without explaining his apparent misinformation. In a March 12, 1967 Face the Nation interview on CBS, Clark declined to comment on his previous inaccurate remarks about Clay Shaw, stating, quote, it would be inappropriate for me to comment on the case, unquote. Well, he apparently did not feel that way before. He sure commented on it and did so erroneously. Continuing now with Fensterwald's account. In the same interview, CBS correspondent George Herman, H-E-R-M-A-N, questioned the Attorney General about the FBI's secret classified files on David Ferry, the other key assassination suspect in Garrison's investigation. Herman asked, quote, now, Mr. Ferry has been dead several weeks, and the Ferry material is still classified, and I wonder if that is at the order of the FBI and Justice Department, unquote. Clark replied, quote, no, those documents are under the general jurisdiction of the General Services Administration at this time, unquote. This, and then Fensterwald goes on to say, this statement was also inaccurate as the Ferry documents had specifically been classified under orders from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and his aides. The Ferry documents were also subsequently withheld from Jim Garrison by the Justice Department when Garrison subpoenaed them for his investigation. That last sentence again. The Ferry documents were also subsequently withheld from Jim Garrison by the Justice Department when Garrison subpoenaed them for his investigation. And skipping down in Fensterwald's text here, we find, on the last day that Clark served as Attorney General, he ordered the Justice Department to withhold from New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison the X-rays and photographs from the autopsy of President Kennedy. Garrison had subpoenaed these items in connection with his unsuccessful prosecution of Clay Shaw, and his subpoena had been upheld by a judge in Washington, D.C. Clark, however, appealed the judge's ruling, and the materials were never, in fact, produced. And bear in mind, again, the death of Lieutenant William Pitzer, a supposed suicide, but the gun was in the wrong hands. In the wrong hand, I should say, that also has worked to obscure evidence in the vis-a-vis the autopsy photographs of President Kennedy. I would also note, in addition to helping to frustrate Garrison's investigation, darling of the progressives, Ramsey Clark, also neglected to investigate the assassination of Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy to any significant extent. Reading again from Penn Jones' Forgive My Grief, Volume 3 of Ramsey Clark and the Martin Luther King assassination, Penn Jones writes, from April 11th of 1968, Since the assassination of President Kennedy, the Justice Department has been honed to a fine edge as a tool for punishing criminals. Under the Mickey Mouse Attorney General, as Jim Garrison calls him, Ramsey Clark of Dallas can determine before a suspect is caught that there was no conspiracy. On TV, Clark has solemnly proclaimed, and again this is April 11, 1968, beginning again on TV, Clark has solemnly proclaimed that there was absolutely no conspiracy involved in the killing of Dr. King. Of course, the suspect, who may not be guilty, hasn't even been apprehended, but we are sure there was no conspiracy. That's 1 week after Martin Luther King was assassinated. Clark performed the same way vis-a-vis the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And again, bear in mind that Ramsey Clark, in addition to his work as Attorney General, had been a Justice Department liaison with the Warren Commission and had been instrumental in helping to frustrate Jim Garrison's investigation. We're going to come back in just a couple of minutes and begin exploring some other aspects of the Kennedy assassination. Again, this is just a random sampling of this massive body of information that Professor Chomsky has chosen not to look into, even though he poo-poos the notion that there might have been a conspiracy behind President Kennedy's assassination. Music, and then the rest of tonight's prepared portion. Resuming, I should say, the prepared portion of tonight's program, we're again just going to look at a few more pieces of information vis-a-vis Kennedy's assassination. This first one is one of the many pieces of hard evidence that was overlooked by the Warren Commission and subsequent investigators and those advocates of political orthodoxy who view people like myself and Penn Jones and the others who have done research into the Kennedy assassination and other political assassinations as heretics. Well, unfortunately, there's an awful lot of information, a wide body of information, which people such as Noam Chomsky have chosen to ignore, and apparently, at least according to Chomsky, he doesn't intend to pay any attention to it. That is very tragic in my estimation. Now, taking a look once again at some of the hard evidence of conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, we are going to look once again at Forgive My Grief, Volume 3 by Penn Jones. And in the first of two segments of this book termed, titled by Penn Jones, Number Please, we find the following. A story about fraudulent long-distance calls appearing in the Dallas Morning News of June 29, 1969, recalled for us an incident about telephone company records at the time of the assassination of President Kennedy. Southwestern Bell Telephone Company's Jim Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-A-N, was quoted, quote, "We have one of the most extensive security networks in the country. Most of our people are former FBI men," unquote. Long ago, we learned that several high-ranking telephone people in Dallas hurried to the police shortly after Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald with phone company records proving that Ruby and Oswald knew each other. At Dallas police headquarters, the men were told to go home and forget it. All the phone company men were hastily transferred out of Dallas. And still later, in another segment of the book entitled Number Please, we find the following, more about the identity of these same individuals. The Warren Commission stated in Volume 15, page 265, that Bruce Carlin, C-A-R-L-I-N, telephoned Connor's Food Store in McGregor, Texas on October 9, 1963. Carlin was shunned... Next page. Also termed Number Please, that's why I had it. This is the same title. Of the telephone records, Southwestern Bell's records, that in fact Oswald and Ruby knew each other. The Warren Commission stated that they were strangers. Penn Jones writes as follows, Ray Acker, A-C-K-E-R, was a high-level employee of American Bell Telephone Company in Dallas at the time of the assassination. When law officers and newspapers started saying that Ruby and Oswald did not know each other, Acker went to the FBI with telephone long-distance records to prove that Ruby and Oswald did know each other. The FBI told Acker to go home and forget it. Acker and two of his assistants were transferred shortly thereafter to Kansas City, Missouri. Again, hard information concerning various aspects of the Kennedy assassination conspiracy, information which tragically many people, including people who should know better, have chosen to ignore. We're now going to take a look at some of the many unexplored areas, just a few of the many unexplored areas of President Kennedy's assassination and the events and people around it. These are not hard connections, although with proper investigation they might turn out to be that. Another of the suspicious deaths that Penn Jones has chronicled in connection with Kennedy's assassination is the death of a fellow named John M. Crawford, C-R-A-W-F-O-R-D. Of Crawford's death and its significance vis-a-vis the Kennedy assassination, Penn Jones writes as follows. This is from April 24th of 1969. John M. Crawford, 46, died in a mysterious plane crash near Huntsville, Texas on Tuesday, April 15, 1969. Crawford, pilot of the Department of Corrections plane, took off late at night without authority and within minutes nosedived into a muddy field a few miles from the airport. Five other persons also died in the crash. Others who died were airport manager George Robert Clark, C-L-A-R-K, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Green, G-R-E-E-N-E, and the Greens' two children. Investigators found the cars of all three men at the airport with ignition keys still in the locks and Mrs. Green's purse on the seat of the Green car. The Dallas Morning News of Friday, April 18, 1969, says, quote, a stereo set was still playing in Clark's trailer home at the airport when investigators checked Wednesday morning, indicating he may have left in a hurry. I'd say the fact that Mrs. Green's purse was still on the seat of the car and all three men's ignition keys were still in the ignitions of their cars would definitely indicate that they left in a hurry. Again, quoting that news story, an airport attendant said the position of the wheel blocks where the plane had been stored in its hangar indicated the departure had been carried out in a rush, unquote. Crawford was a homosexual and a close friend of Jack Ruby. Ruby carried Crawford's name and phone number in his pocket at all times. Crawford was also a lifetime friend of Buell Wesley Fraser, F-R-A-Z-I-E-R, the neighbor who took Oswald to work that fatal morning of November 22, 1963. Crawford and Fraser grew up together in Huntsville, Texas. So although not an absolutely hard connection, the death of John Crawford looks pretty mysterious. These people were certainly afraid of something. And again, note that Crawford was a homosexual and a close friend of Jack Ruby. I don't pass judgment on his sexual preference. That Ruby carried Crawford's name and phone number in his pocket at all times. And note that Crawford was a lifetime friend of Buell Wesley Fraser, the neighbor who took Oswald to work that fatal morning of November 22nd, 1963. Not a hard connection, but as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research, and a connection which, with investigation, might prove very, very revealing. One of the reasons why it is important to study our political assassinations is that much of the political history of the United States of the last 30 years would be revealed for what it is if, in fact, those investigations were to be carried out. Another unexplored area of political skullduggery in the United States concerns the Chappaquiddick incident in which Ted Kennedy is alleged to have driven his car off a bridge and Mary Jo Kopechne had a woman in attendance at a party with Ted Kennedy died in that incident. Many political researchers, as well as some Kennedy staffers, have stated that President Kennedy was planning on replacing Lyndon Johnson, who, of course, succeeded him after his assassination. He was planning on replacing Lyndon Johnson on the Democratic ticket in 1964 with Senator George Smathers of Florida. Smathers, by the way, a good friend of Richard Nixon. Penn Jones, in Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, speculates, and I think his speculation is worthy of investigation, that LBJ aide Bobby Baker, an individual who was steeped in scandal in the 1960s, may have learned of Kennedy's plans to dump LBJ, and that perhaps the leak came from the fact that his secretary, Miss Carol Tyler, was the roommate of George Smathers' secretary. Smathers' secretary was Mary Jo Kopechne. And we're going to take a look at the death of Mary Jo Kopechne in the Chappaquiddick incident, also the mysterious death of Miss Carol Tyler in the crash of a private plane, just like Hugh Ward, and just like the John M. Crawford, the Ruby associate and the associate of Buell Wesley Fraser, the Oswald neighbor who drove Oswald to work that particular day. Penn Jones writes on July 31st, 1969, Bobby Baker was about the first person in Washington to know that Lyndon Johnson was to be dumped as the vice presidential candidate in 1964. Baker knew President Kennedy had offered the spot on the ticket to Senator George Smathers of Florida, Smathers, S-M-A-T-H-E-R-S. Baker knew because his secretary, Miss Carol Tyler, roomed with one of George Smathers' secretaries, Miss Mary Jo Kopechne, roomed with one of George Smathers' secretaries. Miss Mary Jo Kopechne had been another of Smathers' secretaries. Now both Miss Tyler and Miss Kopechne have died strangely. These girls' deaths, we feel, should make us all recall the ties of the Johnson crew to the John Kennedy assassination conspiracy. In addition to Bobby Baker, we feel the conduct and actions of Senator Robert Kerr, K-E-R-R, dead, Clifton C. Carter, Walter Jenkins, Herman Brown, dead, and Roy Cohn should all be reevaluated along with that of Lyndon Johnson. We think it quite possible Senator Edward Kennedy knows no more of what happened in his, quote, accident, unquote, than did Miss Tyler and her pilot, who dived so mysteriously into the Atlantic Ocean. Certainly, we feel there was no plan for the senator to escape. Someday, a diligent researcher who will be able to point to the traitor inside the Kennedy ranks, but not yet. Not yet. Again, a line of speculation undertaken here by Penn Jones, but Bobby Baker is widely believed to have known about Kennedy's plans to dump LBJ. Again, one of his secretaries, Mary Jo Kopechne, roomed with Carol Tyler. Carol Tyler, like so many others, killed in the crash of a private plane, like Hugh Ward, like De Lesseps Morrison, like John Crawford, who we just looked at. And it should be noted again that the Chappaquiddick incident badly damaged the political reputation of Senator Edward Kennedy, the lone surviving Kennedy brother at that time. And as we looked at last week, Nixon aides John Caulfield and Anthony Ulasewicz were deeply involved in the Chappaquiddick incident. Ulasewicz was posing as a reporter the day at a press conference the day after the incident, asking embarrassing questions. And John Caulfield had put together a plan to blackmail many of the women who had been present at the party prior to the Chappaquiddick incident and the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, and to blackmail them for various purposes unnamed. Among the many people who have raised their voices in protest of the Oliver Stone film, of the Garrison investigation, is the NPR reporter Cokie Roberts. Now, Cokie Roberts has stated that she wouldn't see the JFK movie because her father was a member of the Warren Commission, and indeed her father was. Her father was the late Representative Hale Boggs, B-O-G-G-S, of Louisiana. He was a member of the Warren Commission, but had Cokie Roberts investigated a little further, she would have discovered that her father had been one of the dissenting members of the Warren Commission and had been deeply critical of various aspects of the Warren Commission's investigation.